Good morning. Feels like it. So, welcome. Nice to be here on May Day, a beautiful May Day. Mm-hmm. I'm sure when I was driving over here, there were some little flecks of snow hitting my windshield. And there's quite a wind coming off the lake, so. But we like it, right? It's a beautiful day. They're all beautiful. So, my talk this morning could be entitled, "And Now for Something Completely Different." And I say that because it's just been a little while since practice period ended. And for those of you who are new and don't know what practice period is, I'll tell you. It's something we do here twice a year. We do it in the spring and in the fall. And it lasts 8 weeks, and during that time, if you choose to participate, you make a commitment to a certain amount of sitting regularly. And we get together once a week, and we talk about how our practice is going, and we have a talk, and we study a text. And it's really great. And if you've been around for a while, I would really encourage you to take part in those. And this year, the one we just concluded, we were studying Dogen. And so I gave three talks on Dogen. And he's one of the most important figures in Soto Zen, if not the most important figure. And I really enjoyed those talks, and they were great. But Dogen is very challenging. That was very hard. And so I thought for this time I would look for something that was a little more, what's the word I'm looking for here? Easy. That's it. So today I'm going to talk about one of my favorite short stories. And this is a short story by Ernest Hemingway. It's called Big Two-Hearted River. And I first read this story in high school. When I was a junior in high school, I had English class, and we had a textbook for that, which compiled various things from literature. And Big Two-Hearted River Part 1 was in that. It actually has two parts, and I'm going to talk about both parts today. But Part 1 was in that book, and I read it, and I loved it. There was something about this story that really struck me. And I didn't see all the layers of meaning at that time because it's really quite complex. It's deceptively simple, but it's quite complex. To me, at that time, it seemed like this is about a guy who goes fishing and nothing really happens. And yet there was something that really drew me into it. And I've kept coming back and reading it over and over during the years. And something about it resonates with me. I think something about the thing I need to do in my Zen practice must be in here a little bit. So you might say it kind of resonates with my personal koan. And it has to do with kind of the question of what do we do about going to the scary and dark places in our life? I guess that's one of the things I need to work on. And as Buddhists, we talk quite a lot about not indulging during the process, indulging in thinking, I should say, during the process of meditation or during the process of mindfulness. Mindfulness being paying very close attention to our activities, things we do throughout the day, such as washing the dishes or shoveling the snow or sewing or something like that. Just being very present with that activity and not involving thought. And when we can do this, we quiet our minds, and this opens us to a more awakened state where we can see the world as it is without the filter of our thoughts. So it's a more immediate way of being in the world, and it has to do with concentrating on our activities or our meditation and letting go of thought. And in this story, Hemingway presents a character who uses a kind of mindfulness to still his thoughts. And the question is, how is it similar to what we do, and how is it different? And I find that very interesting. So that's what I'm going to look at here. So it's pretty long. I can't read it all, but I'm going to read parts of it, and the rest I'm going to fill in with a little narration. So I'm going to read you a story, so relax. Excuse me. Better have a sip of water first. I'm a little froggy this morning. I have to apologize for that. The train went on up the track, out of sight, around one of the hills of burnt timber. Nick sat down on the bundle of canvas and bedding the baggage man had pitched out of the door of the baggage car. There was no town, nothing but the rails and the burned-over country. The 13 saloons that had lined the one street of Sini had left not a trace. The foundations of the Mansion House Hotel stuck up above the ground. The stone was chipped and split by the fire. It was all that was left of the town of Sini. Even the surface had been burned off the ground. Nick looked at the burned-over stretch of hillside where he had expected to find the scattered houses of the town, and then walked down the railroad track to the bridge over the river. The river was there. It swirled against the log spiles of the bridge. Nick looked down into the clear brown water, colored from the pebbly bottom, and watched the trout keeping themselves steady in the current with wavering fins. As he watched them, they changed their positions by quick angles, only to hold steady in the fast water again. Nick watched them a long time. He watched them holding themselves with their noses into the current, many trout in deep, fast-moving water, slightly distorted as he watched far down through the glassy, convex surface of the pool, its surface pushing and swelling smooth against the resistance of the log-driven piles of the bridge. At the bottom of the pool were the big trout. Nick did not see them at first. Then he saw them at the bottom of the pool, big trout looking to hold themselves on the gravel bottom in a varying mist of gravel and sand raised in spurts by the current. Nick looked down into the pool from the bridge. It was a hot day. A kingfisher flew up the stream. It was a long time since Nick had looked into a stream and seen trout. They were very satisfactory. As the shadow of the kingfisher moved up the stream, a big trout shot upstream in a long angle, only his shadow marking the angle, then lost his shadow as he came through the surface of the water, caught the sun, and then, as he went back into the stream under the surface, his shadow seemed to float down the stream with the current, unresisting, to his post under the bridge, where he tightened, facing up into the current. Nick's heart tightened as the trout moved. He felt all the old feeling. He turned and looked down the stream. It stretched away, pebbly-bottomed with shallows and big boulders and a deep pool as it curved away around the foot of a bluff. Nick walked back up the ties to where his pack lay in the cinders beside the railway track. He was happy. So that's the beginning. And Nick puts on his heavy pack and he begins to walk. And it's slow going. He's walking through this burned-out country. And then finally he gets to a place where it's no longer burned, and he comes to a pine plain, and he starts walking through these pines. And after a while, he takes off his pack and takes a rest. Nick sat down against the charred stump and smoked a cigarette. His pack balanced on top of the stump, harness holding ready, a hollow molded in it from his back. Nick sat smoking, looking out over the country. He did not need to get his map out. He knew where he was from the position of the river. As he smoked, his legs stretched out in front of him. He noticed a grasshopper walk along the ground and up onto his woolen sock. The grasshopper was black. As he had walked along the road, climbing, he had started many grasshoppers from the dust. They were all black. They were not the big grasshoppers with yellow and black or red and black wings whirring out from their black wing sheathing as they fly up. These were just ordinary hoppers, but all a sooty black in color. Nick had wondered about them as he walked without really thinking about them. Now, as he watched the black hopper that was nibbling at the wool of his sock with its four-way lip, he realized that they had all turned black from living in the burned-over land. He realized that the fire must have come the year before, but the grasshoppers were all black now. He wondered how long they would stay that way. So he's been here before fishing, but he didn't even know about the fire. He gets off the train. He's kind of surprised by all this. So he walks for a long time with his heavy pack. He falls asleep. He wakes up, he's stiff and cramped, and he sees that the sun is nearly down. So he gets moving. He's headed for this certain camp that I think he knows from before. The ground rose, wooded and sandy, to overlook the meadow, the stretch of river, and the swamp. Nick dropped his pack and rod case and looked for a level piece of ground. He was very hungry, and he wanted to make his camp before he cooked. Between two jack pines, the ground was quite level. He took the axe out of the pack and chopped out two projecting roots. That leveled a piece of ground large enough to sleep on. He smoothed out the sandy soil with his hand and pulled all the sweet fern bushes by their roots. His hand smelled good from the sweet fern. He smoothed the uprooted earth. He did not want anything making lumps under the blankets. When he had the ground smooth, he spread his three blankets. One he folded double next to the ground. The other two he spread on top. The axe he slid off a bright slab of pine from one of the stumps and split it into pegs for the tent. He wanted it long and solid to hold in the ground. With the tent unpacked and spread on the ground, the pack, leaning against a jack pine, looked much smaller. Nick tied the rope and served the tent for a ridge pole to the trunk of one of the pine trees, and pulled the tent up off the ground with the other end of the rope and tied it to the other pine. The tent hung on the rope like a canvas blanket on a clothesline. He poked a pole he had cut up under the back peak of the canvas and made it a tent by pegging out the sides. He pegged the sides out taut, rolling to the feet. And then we have... He started a fire with some chunks of pine he got with the axe from a stump. Over the fire, he stuck a wire grill, pushing the forelegs down into the ground with his boot. Nick put the frying pan on the grill over the flames. He was hungrier. The beans and spaghetti warmed. Nick stirred them and mixed them together. They began to bubble, making little bubbles that rose with difficulty to the surface. There was a good smell. Nick got out a bottle of tomato ketchup and cut four slices of bread. The little bubbles were coming faster now. Nick sat down beside the fire and lifted the frying pan off. He poured about half the contents out into the tin plate. It spread slowly on the plate. Nick knew it was too hot. He poured on some tomato ketchup. He knew the beans and spaghetti were still too hot. He looked at the fire, then at the tent. He was not going to spoil it all by burning his tongue. For years he had never enjoyed fried bananas because he had never been able to wait for them to cool. His tongue was very sensitive. He was very hungry. Across the river in the swamp, in the almost dark, he saw a mist rising. He looked at the tent once more. All right. He took a full spoonful from the plate. I love that. Now, the first time, and probably the first few times I read that, I didn't really get the thing about burning his tongue. But that's pretty cool. Have you ever been so hungry that you've eaten something you knew was too hot and burned your tongue? I've done that quite a few times, actually. But Nick is not going to do that. He is not going to do that because he's very disciplined. He did all that walking. He set up his tent. And he is not going to sort of indulge in his desires until the time is right. He's holding off. I like that. And another thing that happens here is just at this point before, you know, when he really, really, really wants to give in, across the river in the swamp in the almost dark, he saw a mist rising. This is where the swamp kind of gets introduced. This is like kind of the place he doesn't want to go to right now. He doesn't want to give in. He doesn't want to give in. He doesn't want to become weak. And he looks over, and there's that swamp over there. We'll see more of the swamp pretty soon. And then, Nick drove another big nail and hung up the bucket full of water. He dipped the coffee pot half full, put some more chips under the grill onto the fire, and put the pot on. He could not remember which way he made coffee. He could remember an argument about it with Hopkins, but not which side he had taken. He decided to bring it to a boil. He remembered now that was Hopkins' way. He had once argued about everything with Hopkins. While he waited for the coffee to boil, he opened a small can of apricots. He liked to open cans. He emptied the can of apricots out into a tin cup. While he watched the coffee on the fire, he drank the juice syrup of the apricots, carefully at first to keep from spilling, then meditatively sucking the apricots down. They were better than fresh apricots. The coffee boiled as he watched. The lid came up and coffee and grounds ran down the side of the pot. Nick took it off the grill. It was a triumph for Hopkins. And then he talks a lot more about Hopkins. He goes into this very much a long paragraph where he's remembering Hopkins, and he's remembering one memory leads to another, and it all gets to a place which is kind of sad at the end, which is that he and Hopkins and their friends, all their circle kind of broke up at the end of the summer. They said goodbye and all felt bad. It broke up the trip. They never saw Hopkins again. That was a long time ago on the Black River. Now, this is something very different entering the story, right? Because until now, there's been no thought. He said at one point that something was very satisfactory. That's about all we get. Now, all of a sudden, it's the very end of the day. All of his chores are done. He's drinking his coffee, and all these thoughts come flooding in. Nick drank the coffee according to Hopkins. The coffee was bitter. Nick laughed. It made a good ending to the story. His mind was starting to work. He knew he could choke it because he was tired enough. He spilled the coffee out of the pot and shook the grounds loose into the fire. He lit a cigarette and went inside the tent. He took off his shoes and trousers, sitting on the blankets, rolled the shoes up inside the trousers for a pillow, and got in between the blankets. So there's this little line in there that I'd never noticed the first time. His mind was starting to work. He knew he could choke it because he was tired enough. That's a very significant line, and Hemingway's a very subtle writer, and he's not going to come out and tell you what's going on here, but that line really says a lot. Nick is trying to choke his mind, and I'll give you a little background here, because there's something I didn't know when I read this, and that you couldn't know unless you're familiar with these stories, and that is that Nick Adams is a reoccurring character. He occurs in many stories of Ernest Hemingway, so we kind of know a lot about his life. And here on this camping trip, he has recently come back from the war, World War I. He was in Italy, and in Italy he was wounded, and he saw some very bad things, and he actually has had a mental breakdown in Italy. And that kind of puts things into perspective here. There's a little note of desperation here to his mindfulness, because he's trying to keep these thoughts from coming in. He needs to choke his mind. It's easy at the end of the day because he's very tired. There's an earlier story where he's in Italy and he's talking to an Italian captain and some other people, and he's losing it. And he goes on and on about his memories of fishing with grasshoppers. And here's an example of a sentence from that story, which is very different from the sentences in this story. The larger ones that fly, making a noise somewhat similar to that produced by a rattlesnake rattling his rattles, a very dry sound, have vivid colored wings. Some are bright red, others yellow, barred with black, but their wings go to pieces in the water, and they make a very blowsy bait, while the medium brown is a plump, compact, succulent hopper that I can recommend as well as one may recommend something you gentlemen will probably never encounter. His thoughts are quite uncontrolled there, quite different. And that story is called A Way You'll Never Be, which I think is a pretty funny title, because it's sort of saying to the reader, it's kind of mocking the reader, oh, you'll never be like this, you'll never have uncontrolled thoughts, you know, and kind of saying, well, everybody has the potential for this, you know, not so much to crack up, but the potential to have thoughts that just kind of run wild and you really want them to stop. Everybody's got that in them. And then there was another earlier story called Now I Lay Me, and it's about laying awake all night, trying to stave off sleep. And in that story, he says, I myself did not want to sleep. This is after he's wounded. He's in kind of a rehabilitation center. The nights are very tough for him. I myself did not want to sleep because I had been living for a long time with the knowledge that if I ever shut my eyes and let myself go, my soul would go out of my body. I had been that way for a long time, ever since I had been blown up at night and felt it go out of me and then go off and then come back. So this is different from Nick in the woods. In the woods, or back then when he was in the rehabilitation place, he was afraid to go to sleep. And so he was engaging in kind of systematic thoughts, remembering Trout's dreams, things like that, so he would not go to sleep. But here in the woods, he welcomes sleep to cut off his thoughts. But the important thing is, he's worried about his soul leaving his body. He's worried about losing his sense of self. You might say he has a great fear of no self, of not having a self. So, you know, the burned over country that he finds upon coming back to the United States from Italy, we might say is kind of a symbol of his mental state. It's very, very damaged. And the grasshoppers here are all black, not colorful the way they were when he was so, his mind was so busy in Italy. And he says in this story, he wondered how long they would stay that way. So he's wondering, you know, how long are my thoughts, am I going to have to squelch these thoughts in this way? So then part one ends with one more paragraph. Out through the front of the tent, he watched the glow of the fire when the night wind blew on it. It was a quiet night. The swamp was perfectly quiet. The swamp's perfectly quiet. It's okay at this point. Nick stretched under the blanket comfortably. A mosquito hummed close to his ear. Nick sat up and lit a match. The mosquito was on the canvas over his head. Nick moved the match quickly up to it. The mosquito made a satisfactory hiss in the flame. The match went out. Nick lay down under the blanket. He turned on his side and shut his eyes. He was sleepy. He felt sleep coming. He curled up under the blanket and went to sleep. And I often have wondered why he kills the mosquito, you know, so deliberately, and it makes this satisfactory hiss. And if you've ever spent the night in a tent with a mosquito, as I have, you know why he did it. But still, the satisfactory hiss in the flame. I think this actually is kind of significant, and I'll come back to this a little bit later. So that's part one. And then part two is the next day when he does some fishing. And it's longer, and I will read much, much less here, but I will try to read enough to give you some flavor of it. So it begins like this. In the morning, the sun was up and the tent was starting to get hot. Nick crawled out under the mosquito netting stretched across the mouth of the tent to look at the morning. The grass was wet on his hands as he came out. He held his trousers and his shoes in his hands. The sun was just up over the hill. There was the meadow, the river, and the swamp. There were birch trees in the green of the swamp on the other side of the river. The river was clear and smoothly fast in the early morning. Down about 200 yards were three logs all the way across the stream. They made the water smooth and deep above them. As Nick watched, a mink crossed the river on the logs and went into the swamp. Nick was excited. He was excited by the early morning and the river. He was really too hurried to eat breakfast, but he knew he must. He built a little fire and put on the coffee pot. So, while the water was heating, he goes out and he finds some grasshoppers, taking only the medium-sized brown ones. And then he cooks his breakfast, same kind of deliberate stuff, really delightful to read, I think. And then he begins to fish. And there are quite a few pages of fishing here. He catches a fish. He catches one fish. And then he's working on another one. He wallowed down the stream, above his knees in the current, through the 50 yards of shallow water above the pile of logs that crossed the stream. He did not rebait his hook and held it in his hand as he waited. He was certain he could catch small trout in the shallows, but he did not want them. There would be no big trout in the shallows this time of day. Now the water deepened up his thighs sharply and coldly. Ahead was the smooth, dammed back flood of water above the logs. The water was smooth and dark. On the left, the lower edge of the meadow. On the right, the swamp. Nick leaned back against the current and took a hopper from the bottle. He threaded the hopper on the hook and spat on him for good luck. Then he pulled several yards of line from the reel and tossed the hopper out ahead onto the fast, dark water. It floated down towards the logs. Then the weight of the line pulled the bait under the surface. Nick held the rod in his right hand, letting the line run through his fingers. There was a long tug. Nick struck, and the rod came alive and dangerous, bent double, the line tightening, coming out of water, tightening, all in a heavy, dangerous, steady pull. Nick felt the moment when the leader would break if the strain increased and let the line go. The reel ratcheted into a mechanical shriek as the line went out in a rush, too fast. Nick could not check it, the line rushing out, the reel note rising as the line ran out. With the core of the reel showing, his heart feeling stopped with the excitement, leaning back against the current that mounted icily his thighs, Nick thumbed the reel hard with his left hand. It was awkward getting his thumb inside the fly reel frame. As he put on pressure, the line tightened into sudden hardness, and beyond the logs, a huge trout went high out of water. As he jumped, Nick lowered the tip of the rod. But he felt, as he dropped the tip to ease the strain, the moment when the strain was too great, the hardness too tight. Of course, the leader had broken. There was no mistaking the feeling when all spring left the line and it became dry and hard. Then it went slack. His mouth dry, his heart down, Nick reeled in. He had never seen so big a trout. There was a heaviness, a power not to be held, and then the bulk of him as he jumped. He looked as broad as a salmon. Nick's hand was shaky. He reeled in slowly. The thrill had been too much. He felt vaguely a little sick, as though it would be better to sit down. So I think he's confronting something here. The current that mounted icily his thighs, that's something, the current, he doesn't like that cold feeling, and that's something that's kind of associated with the swamp. He is confronting something here, but he's not really going inward. He's not really going inward looking at these fears. He's confronting something that is outside of him, and it is very hard for him. It's making him feel weak and sick, and maybe in a way it's kind of bringing up these bad memories for him. So then there is more, and he catches, I think, a second trout. I think he catches two in all. And then, getting toward the end here, through the deepening water, Nick waded over to the hollow log. He took the sack off over his head. This is a sack with two live trout in it. The trout flopping as it came out of water, and hung it so the trout were deep in the water. Then he pulled himself up on the log and sat, the water from his trouser and boots running down into the stream. He laid his rod down, moved along to the shady end of the log, and took the sandwiches out of his pocket. He dipped the sandwiches in the cold water. The current carried away the crumbs. He ate the sandwiches and dipped his hat full of water to drink, the water running out through his hat just ahead of his drinking. It was cool in the shade, sitting on the log. He took a cigarette out and struck a match to light it. The match sunk into the gray wood, making a tiny furrow. Nick leaned over the side of the log, found a hard place, and lit the match. He sat smoking and watching the river. Ahead, the river narrowed and went into a swamp. The river became smooth and deep, and the swamp looked solid with cedar trees, their trunks close together, their branches solid. It would not be possible to walk through a swamp like that. The branches grew so low. You would have to keep almost level with the ground to move at all. You could not crash through the branches. That must be why the animals that lived in swamps were built the way they were, Nick thought. I think that's the first time the words Nick thought appears. The thinking, it's coming back here. He wished he had brought something to read. He felt like reading. He did not feel like going on into the swamp. He looked down the river. A big cedar slanted all the way across the stream. Beyond that, the river went into the swamp. Nick did not want to go in there now. He felt a reaction against deep wading with the water deepening up under his armpits to hook big trout in places impossible to land them. In the swamp, the banks were bare. The big cedars came together overhead. The sun did not come through except in patches. In the fast, deep water, in the half-light, the fishing would be tragic. In the swamp, fishing was a tragic adventure. Nick did not want it. He did not want to go down the stream any further today. And then there are two paragraphs where he cleans the fish. He kills them by knocking their heads on stone and then stone and then cleaning the fish. And I'll spare you the details. He washed the trout in the stream. When he held them back up in the water, they looked like live fish. Their color was not gone yet. He washed his hands and dried them on the log. Then he laid the trout on the sack spread out on the log, rolled them up in it, tied the bundle, and put it in the landing net. His knife was still standing, blade stuck in the log. He cleaned it on the wood and put it in his pocket. Nick stood up on the log, holding his rod, the landing net hanging heavy, then stepped into the water and splashed ashore. He climbed the bank and cut up into the woods toward the high ground. He was going back to camp. He looked back. The river just showed through the trees. There were plenty of days coming when he could fish the swamp. And that's the end of the story. So for Nick, I think the swamp is kind of a symbol of the uncontrolled mind, the loss of self, perhaps, the soul leaving the body, all things that Nick greatly fears, of course, because he's had this terrible experience. And so he's kind of fighting desperately not to go to that place, and he's doing it through mindfulness. He's doing it through paying very close attention to his daily activities. So that's one way to do mindfulness. And we can contrast this, I think, with a Buddhist view of how to deal with dark, scary places. And when I think of the Buddhist view of doing that, I think of one of my favorite writers, who is Pema Chodron. And I often talk about this. Pema Chodron is, she's not a Zen person, she's in the Tibetan tradition, but she writes really beautifully about sort of how Zen practice for each individual tends to be a bit of a journey into our own minds and our own memories and things that are going on there. It seems that we all kind of have these demons that arise. And we have choices about how we deal with these demons. And Pema talks about how we tend to do anything we can to avoid the things that we fear. And we will do anything we can sometimes to push them away. Sometimes we will make up a story about the thing we fear and we stick to the story instead of really kind of experiencing the fear itself. And every time we do this, we kind of add another little layer of armor. Right? She likes that metaphor of armor. We add these layers of armor because we don't want to confront the thing that we fear. And she says that Buddhist practice is about opening your heart to these things and not fleeing from them. Because I think if you wall away some part of your life, it can do a little damage. And her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, had some things to say about this. And this, I'm going to read a paragraph. It's a little long and it's a little dense, so please stick with me here. The ground of fearlessness, which is the basis for overcoming doubt and wrong belief, is the development of renunciation. Renunciation means overcoming that very hard and tough, aggressive mentality which wards off any gentleness that might come into our hearts. Fear does not allow fundamental tenderness to enter into us. When tenderness tinged by sadness touches our heart, we know that we are in contact with reality. We feel it. That contact is genuine, fresh, and quite raw. That sensitivity is the basic experience of warriorship, and it is the key to developing fearless renunciation. And then he goes on and says something, and this is much less dense, this is more immediate. Warriorship is so tender, without skin, without tissue, naked and raw. It is soft and gentle. You have renounced putting on a new suit of armor. You have renounced growing a thick, hard skin. You are willing to expose naked flesh, bone, and marrow to the world. So when Nick thinks there were plenty of days coming when he could fish the swamp, what does he mean? Does he mean that eventually he's going to be able to sort of develop this vulnerability and be there with his fear, fully be there? Or does he mean that he's going to sort of continue to build his strength, and eventually he'll be able to go into that swamp as a sort of conqueror with his self intact? Is he going to kind of let his self go a little bit and kind of say, okay, I'm not in control? Is he going to go to that scary place, or is he going to go into the swamp saying, I am in control? Well, it's maybe not really clear from the story, but I think we have a couple of hints. And one is that mosquito that he kills at the end of part one, and the two fish that he kills at the end of part two. I mean, this is certainly a way of engaging the world, which involves a kind of a conquering mentality, a kind of me versus the world. I am going to sort of beat something in the world and keep myself intact. The idea, I think, is that if you make yourself strong enough, you can conquer anything. And if you know about Hemingway's life, and I've read, you know, a lot of his stuff, most of it, I guess I would say, in a biography, you might suspect that he would have Nick go back to the swamp only as a conqueror, that that's his way of dealing with fears in life. And if you know about Hemingway's life, you know that things didn't go so well for him toward the end. When he was young and strong and he was a great writer, things went very, very well. But as he got older, his personal life got kind of unraveled and he had difficulty writing. And he really needed large quantities of alcohol to keep the whole thing going, this kind of whole macho thing he had going. And ended up, of course, ultimately committing suicide. So it didn't go so well for him. And I don't mean to oversimplify here, because there were several people in his family who committed suicide, and there were a lot of things going on. He had a lot of problems. I don't mean to say sort of, you know, this worldview doesn't work, and that's the end of the story. But I'm trying to make a point here about two approaches to scary places. And in the Buddhist approach, there is more of an opening and an acceptance. And at the heart of the Buddhist approach is this idea of no self. No self. Which is something that's, if you're new to Buddhism, I think is a little hard to see, and it sounds strange, and it sounds maybe a little scary. But the idea behind no self is that these egos we have that we go forth with in the world, which are very useful things and helpful and necessary, that there is a sense in which these egos are fictional. That there is sort of, there is this world, and there is this sort of made-up self that thinks the world revolves around the made-up self. And if we can really, really quiet our minds, we can see that, you know what, it's really, it's not about us. It's not about us. And if we spend all of our time sort of fighting to preserve this fragile ego, we end up telling ourselves lies about what the world is really like, you know? And if we kind of let go of that and say, well, you know, it's not about Ted. It is what it is. And I'm going to kind of give Ted a little rest here and just kind of see what's there and let it come to me instead of me going toward it and trying to control it and fix it and make it do what I need it to do. I'm going to kind of let that Ted go and see what's here, moment to moment. Kind of a more exciting and scary and wonderful way to do things. And so instead of desperately trying to protect ego, we kind of let go of ego. And part of this is going to the places that scare us. And the way this works on the cushion is that we sit very quietly. We sit very quietly, and if we're new to this, we follow our breath, and we do that for a long time. And as it begins to quiet things down, then sometimes we can sit without following our breath, without any technique. And things just come up. Things come up. Sometimes emotions come up. Difficult things come up. And how do we deal with those difficult things when they come up? That's the big question. Do we push them away? Do we say, oh no, I'm a good meditator. I'm not a confused person. We want that confusion to go away. So we build up a little armor there, here in the midst of our Zen practice. Or we kind of let it in and go, Oh, yeah, that's right. I am a confused person. Here it comes. You let it in. You let it in. And that's why warriorship is so tender, without skin, without tissue, naked and raw. And you can only go to that place if you have great kindness to do this. And I think that's what's missing from Hemingway's view. I think his view has this really, it has this hard edge. It has this hard edge. And I think that's bad for the person who is doing it. It's bad to have that hard edge because there's a little bit of denial of reality in that. And I think it's a little dangerous for the world. And I think it's possible with great kindness and support of others to step back from this conquering attitude and accept that there is nothing to conquer and there is no one to do the conquering. And there's just the kindness of being in the world. And I'd just like to make two final points, and these are because I don't want to be misunderstood. The first is that sometimes it is the right thing to go to this scary place and kind of where you are vulnerable. And that's something you do when you're strong and you're ready. You don't do it if you're not feeling strong and not feeling ready. And in this story, Nick has been traumatized. And if he were to do that now, if he were to open himself up and be really vulnerable, it could have disastrous results. He's barely holding it together here. And so I think it's good that he's using mindfulness in this way and kind of to kind of keep the thoughts away. There are times when it's necessary to encourage a healthy ego, and this is not inconsistent with Buddhist practice at all. We all need this in order to operate in the world. And if you're dealing with serious trauma, as Nick is, you may need all kinds of help in doing this. So I'm not saying that Nick's approach is wrong in this situation. I'm saying that I'm looking at Hemingway's approach in this rather extreme situation. I'm saying I think it reveals something about his approach to life in general. And it's that approach to life in general that I find not so helpful. Although I found it helpful at times, and I found it interesting. But there's something basic and deep there that just doesn't feel quite right. And the second thing is that when I'm talking about not going forth as a conqueror of the world, but instead letting the world come toward us, I am not at all suggesting that we should be passive or not take action or just accept things as they are or accept injustice or anything like that. Rather, just the opposite. Because when we really open ourselves up emotionally, something happens, I think, where we have to be kind in order to do that. And if we're kind to ourselves in this process, we're going to be kinder to other people. And also, if we do this kind of process of letting the self go that I've been talking about, our barriers break down and we see how closely connected we are with other people and how, you know, you're just the same as I am. And whether you feel good is as important to me as whether I feel good. So really, when you open your heart in this way, there's only one thing to do. And that one thing is to make everything better for everyone. And that is a life of taking action, and that is a life of doing stuff. It is not passive at all. When I say let the world come to you, I mean that's how you see the world. See it as it is. Don't impose your filter of thought or your vision on it. Let it come to you. That's how you see it. But you don't leave it as it is. Once you see it as it is, then you want to take action. So there's a kind of laying down the fight that happens simultaneously with a kind of taking up of the fight, which I think is honest and sustainable. So it's letting in no self, letting in the whole deal again and again and again. And I think that's the true warrior. And that's what I have to say this morning. And I would welcome any comments, if anyone has one.
Ted?
Yes?
I liked how you approached that. I was getting more anxious as you were speaking. Like, where's the disclaimer here? Because clearly Hemingway was kind of a tragic figure, and I read a lot of his stuff when I was younger too, and it was a very masculine, virile, self-confident, self-control, and then ultimately he killed himself because he couldn't deal with the fact that he was losing himself as he grew older and losing his virility, and became, I mean, that, you know, that's totally subjective. But it was, I was waiting for, I was sitting there going, okay, how's this going to come together?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, oh, Ted Polgar.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with what you said, and you know, it's kind of helped me to reconcile this, because when I was younger, I bought this book. I always date my books. I bought this in 76, back when I was building the grain elevators in Greeley, Colorado, and this had a lot of appeal to me back then. You know, I was kind of this traveling construction worker, and you know, I slip back into that a little bit now and then, and you know, it's kind of helping me to kind of reconcile this stuff a little bit.
I do. It's. I think that's kind of. I had that same experience too. But when I was a younger man, I thought in those terms more. And when I look back on it, I can see kind of why he ultimately shot himself, because he was trying to relive that whole virile thing that you can't hold on to, mm-hmm. the grasping. So he's kind of a very tragic figure in my mind.
Yeah. 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 Thank you. Dad.
There's a passage I've always liked. I can't remember what Hemingway book it's from, but it says something like, life breaks everyone. And some people, he says, are strong in those broken places. And I've always thought that he was a man trying to be strong in those broken places and not succeeding. And there's a difference between healing and scarring.
Mm-hmm.
He was a scarred person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's well said. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
So you've read it several times and looked at it through the perspective of your practice, and I'm wondering if you've ever, if you have any thoughts on potential meanings in the title or with the title of the story.
It's Big Two-Hearted River. Not really. Two-hearted. I don't know. It seems sort of dualistic. Could that be sort of reflecting that there's the daytime stuff, the fishing, the stuff without thought that he loves, and then there's that swamp there too, kind of talking about a dualistic, you know. It's kind of, yeah, good and bad, you know. The swamp is bad, stay away from the swamp. The other stuff is good, stay with the good stuff. And we're always talking about non-dualism, and we say, you know, okay, it looks like two, nirvana, samsara, but really they're the same. And we look for how you bring those two hearts together. And like, you know, I mean, if we're out there, we're taking the swamp with us, right? We've got the swamp, we're fishing, but we're, you know, it's sort of here all the time because we don't fear that. We let it in, right? So could be that.
But the swamp is where the big fish are. That's what keeps kind of, that's one of the things that, you know, in the mm-hmm. metaphor is sort of draws him, keeps him sort of thinking he's drawn to that.
Yeah.
Place. That's where the big fish are.
Yeah, I think he wants to be strong enough to go get those big fish. Thank you. Yes, Scott.
Until today, I thought I was the only one who could drink coffee and then go to sleep. Nick Adams is a fictional character.
Right. I can't. That kind of surprised me, too. Last thing he does at night. Who does that? But it made a good story.
Well, of course, he hiked 10 miles and comes back.
That's right. You
know, right.
Yeah. But just to say one more thing. So mm-hmm. This image of the mosquito making the satisfying sizzle reminded me of a backpacking trip I took with two friends to the Porkies. And one of them had never been out in the country backpacking before. And, of course, it was at the peak of the black fly mm-hmm. season when mm-hmm. you didn't want to be outside at all when they were up and awake or you had to be moving rapidly. But we were inside the tent, and, of course, there was this little nylon tent with three of us in there, And there's a black line, several of them, along the peak of the tent. And my friend Wayne hauls out his butane lighter and starts incinerating these black flies. And, of course, we can see the fabric start to pucker. We're seconds away from an incinerated tent. We stopped him.
Okay, I'll resist trying to draw a metaphor out of it.
Well, it's just kind of a different sort of metaphor than the satisfying. We're endangering our own world by incinerating that black fly.
Right. Okay, thank you. Yes.
Could it also, the story that the title referred to, like a jazz phase, two sides of the personality, the face that fears the swamp and the face that is confident about the activity. Like two sides, like typically one of the responses to anxiety or dread or fear is to be cocky. Two sides of the same problem. Two different faces for this. And a person might be conflicted with that. Nick might be conflicted with this doubt. There might be confidence during the day if you know he's actually just escaping, like what he must face eventually.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think that's in there too. A good title has room for many different interpretations. In it. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Well, I think we'll stop with that. Thank you, everyone, for your patience.